Hello there. Today is Friday, January 17th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, U.S. senators are sworn in as the impeachment trial of President Donald J. Trump officially begins.
The OMB, the White House, the administration broke, I'm saying this, broke the law.
A win for Trump with a new North American trade pact. Also ahead, Mariah Carey gets a long overdue recognition. It's all on today's International Edition. The impeachment trial of U.S. President Donald Trump began Thursday with a series of ceremonial procedures that set the stage for opening arguments early next week. For just the third time in U.S. history, senators will sit in judgment of an American president and hear evidence that will lead them to decide whether he should be removed from office. As VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports, the trial is getting underway as Democrats argue new evidence proves the president's guilt in trying to leverage U.S. aid to Ukraine for his own personal benefit.
Do you solemnly swear?
U.S. senators swearing together.
Trial of the impeachment of Donald John Trump.
And then, one by one, signing a book saying they swear to administer that impartial justice to President Trump.
I announce the presence of the managers on the part of the
Those House senators will hear from House Intelligence Chairman Adam Schiff and six other impeachment managers traveling from the House to the Senate to make the case Trump should be removed from office.
In the history of the Republic, no president has ever ordered the complete defiance of an impeachment inquiry. This abuse of office served to cover up the president's own repeated misconduct.
The impeachment process in the Democratic majority U.S. House was a contentious partisan battle. Republican leader Mitch McConnell said the Senate would be different.
This chamber exists precisely, Madam President, so that we can look past the daily dramas and understand how our actions will reverberate for generations.
But Democrats contend that process cannot be fair if senators are not allowed to hear from witnesses and see documents they say prove the president held up aid to Ukraine in return for investigations that would benefit his reelection campaign.
Each of us will face a choice about whether to begin this trial in a search of the truth or in the service of the president's desire to cover up and rush things through.
The trial got underway as an independent government agency announced the Trump administration had broken the law by holding up congressionally approved aid to Ukraine. Trump's Senate ally says there was no impeachable offense.
The Department of Defense told me early on they were worried about the new administration of the Ukraine. When you look at the flow chart, the amount of money going to the Ukraine was virtually the same as it had been before.
But Lev Parnas, an associate of Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, could be a possible trial witness after saying Trump knew exactly what was going on with aid to Ukraine. Trump denies this.
I never had a conversation that I remember with him.
Democrats believe these revelations will increase pressure on McConnell to allow witnesses.
Public opinion has grown enormously for seeing witnesses, eyewitnesses, and documentation, and they'll just have to contend with the public on that.
The trial set to get fully underway next Tuesday when senators return from the holiday weekend. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
Well, meanwhile, the congressional watchdog group, as you heard, found the White House broke the law by withholding security aid for Ukraine approved by Congress, adding to Democrats say that adds to their case. President Trump, though, for his part, spoke to reporters on Thursday and continued to call this a Democratic witch hunt.
Everything was false. You have now the Ukrainian president and the foreign minister of Ukraine saying there was nothing done wrong. In fact, they said there was absolutely no pressure whatsoever. Everything was perfect, and they impeach. It's totally partisan.
Well, joining us now to talk more about what we can expect in this historic moment in U.S. history is Mark Rozelle, Dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Thank you so much for being with us. So tell us a little bit about what comes next here and what to look for.
Not everything is known about what's going to happen next because there is still negotiating going on over whether witnesses will be allowed to testify before the Senate. The Democrats, of course, are making a very strong case that witnesses with direct knowledge of the president's actions, factually, what happened and what did not, should be put before the Senate. And many of the Republicans, of course, are resisting. They would like to see this disposed of, possible. Although there has been some opening up on the part of a number of Republicans to the idea of having at least a limited number of witnesses, which I think from their standpoint would give more of an air of legitimacy to this process and show that they're open to hearing some of the facts rather than just dismissing the case outright. But right now, this is still a work in progress. We even have the Democrats introducing new compelling evidence that can be used against the president, and now Republicans protesting that the articles of impeachment, as they stood based on the previous evidence, is all that they should be looking at. So the two sides, the Democrats and Republicans, really have a lot to work out, and it's not clear exactly what they're going to agree to.
Are they allowed to present new evidence as it comes in when it's specifically related to the articles of impeachment? There were a lot of witnesses and documents that were blocked.
I know of no constitutional or other restriction on members of the House who are presenting their case from introducing new evidence that is germane to the investigation and to making the case against the president, as they're going to be doing. There is no prohibition on presenting any evidence after the date by which the House of Representatives voted in favor of articles of impeachment. So I think on this particular point, the Republicans who are saying that the Democrats cannot introduce any new evidence are on very weak grounds.
Right. And of course, we just heard about this new report from the Government Accountability Office that said that the president violated the country's spending law last year when he blocked or withheld that $391 million in congressionally approved military aid to Ukraine. If that would seem at the heart of this impeachment trial.
Yes, that is true. And in fact, I think the government accountability report is actually some of the most devastating evidence, most devastating part of the case against the president up to this point. So here you have an independent arm of Congress that conducts an analysis of whether the president acted against the law. And to be clear, the Government Accountability Office does not serve on behalf of one political party or the other, and it is staffed by career professionals whose job it is to evaluate on the basis of the merits of the case in this particular circumstance whether the evidence suggests that the president acted beyond the bounds of the law. And the GAO conclusion was that the president had violated the Impoundment Control Act, which prohibits a president from restricting the use of federally appropriated funds that have been approved by Congress and the president previously. And they have concluded, the GAO that is, that the president indeed violated the law by withholding funding that had been properly appropriated by Congress. And that simply is not allowed under our constitutional system.
There's the whole reason that Democrats say the president withheld the money, which was to get the new president of Ukraine to open an investigation into former Vice President Joe Biden. So was that something that was considered, or that, you know, it all kind of fits together and it's all kind of complicating? Yeah. Is more egregious than asking a foreign leader to go after a political opponent?
Right. So here we have really a complication added government accountability office report that said that the president violated the law by withholding funds that were duly appropriated by Congress. The purpose for which the president did so makes this even worse. So if the president had done nothing more than just refuse to allow for the dispensing of funds that were properly appropriated by the federal government, approved by Congress and the president, that would be, strictly speaking, in violation of the Impoundment Control Act. But the reason for which the president did so compounds the egregious violation that took place here, because he was acting on the basis of, as the case has been made in the impeachment case, withholding money in order to extract from the Ukrainian government an action against a domestic political opponent, Joe Biden. So that really compounded, of course, the egregiousness of the action by the president itself.
All right. U.S. history, of course, will provide us more details. That's Mark Rozelle. He's the dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Thank you so much for being with us. Well, on the day that President Trump's Senate impeachment trial formally began, the U.S. president also scored a bipartisan victory as the Senate passed a North American Trade Pact known as USMCA. The international accord replaces the 25-year-old North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, and governs trade between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. VOA's Ardita Dunalari looks at what this pact is expected to deliver both for the U.S. economy and for the president's reelection campaign.
The yeas are 89, the nays are 10, the bill is passed.
By an overwhelming margin, Republican and Democratic senators joined forces to approve the new North America Trade Agreement, or USMCA. Thursday's vote marked a major victory for President Trump on the heels of Wednesday's initial trade accord with China.
I think, quite frankly, the average consumer will see a stronger economy in 2020 as a result of this deal and USMCA. So we expect significant growth.
After initial resistance and numerous negotiations, Democrats and labor unions threw their support behind the agreement that sets rules for $1.2 trillion of trade between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. The pact aims to lower trade barriers and open markets while strengthening labor law enforcement. But USMCA's economic impact could be modest. The U.S. International Trade Commission estimates it will boost American economic activity by just 0.3% compared to NAFTA and increase U.S. employment by 0.8%. But the slight economic improvement is not what's important, says economist Jeffrey Gertz.
The real advantage of getting USMCA signed is it's going to remove some uncertainty over, you know, there had been threats, will Trump pull out of NAFTA? That would be really disastrous for the North American economy overall, particularly relative to China. So I think there's benefits to getting the deal signed and moving forward with more integrated North American economy.
What's undeniable, according to Gertz, is that the deal is a political victory for Trump as he seeks re-election in November.
I think with on both the China deal and USMCA, the politics of it are more interesting. I think this is sort of wrapping up some of what President Trump had promised, again, in a way that allows him to claim victory, even if not that much has changed overall.
Experts point to some improvement in labor rights guarantees, though still far from the standards American unions initially demanded. The agreement has also come under attack over what environmentalists see as concessions to energy companies at a time of global warming. The Senate's top Democrat, Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, said in a statement, "On the greatest issue facing our planet, addressing the climate crisis, the USMCA falls far too short." Ardita Dunelari, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. China applauds the trade deal with the U.S. but says core concerns still have to be addressed. Iran says its uranium enrichment is at a higher level than before the nuclear pact. Poverty and an overwhelmed school system are forcing Sudan's children to work. And the Trump administration offers new guidance for prayer in public schools. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, millions of children in Sudan go to work every day instead of going to school, in part because of widespread poverty and because the education system does not have the resources to accommodate them. Naba Mohideen reports from Khartoum.
15-year-old Murtad Al-Hajj left school 3 years ago to earn a living to support his family. Murtad lives with his parents in Khartoum and makes under $4 per day. The situation hampers his dream to become a doctor.
My mother kept telling me, in the future, and when our life gets better and not worse, I'll study and become a doctor. But all of a sudden, the whole political situation occurred in Sudan.
Sudan is ranked as one of the poorest countries in the world. Soaring prices sparked mass protests that led to the ouster of President Omar al-Bashir last year. The political situation has stabilized, but the economy is still struggling. In Khartoum, it's common to see children working as traders, carpenters, blacksmiths, and at other jobs. Most earn $1 to $1.50 per day. For Murtada and thousands of children his age or younger, they have to choose whether to study or to feed their families.
The children in the area can't afford continuing in school, as the economic condition is very difficult. The children's fathers bring them to us to find them daily work to help them, as life is really hard. It's rare that one of the children continues in this work, but Murtada did, as he lives around the area and his life is hard.
Sudanese officials have signed international agreements to provide free education and outlaw child labor, but have not followed through of any of the accords.
Poverty has a big impact in Sudan to the extent that it is not forbidding child labor, although the law is verified and frankly bans child labor up to the age of 18. The controlling poverty is a serious issue.
More than 3 million school-age children in Sudan are missing out on their education, according to a study carried out by the Ministry of Education and UNICEF. The education minister acknowledged that almost half of all children Murtada's age have no chance to attend school.
The country didn't uphold children's rights. It built a system to only ingest 60% of the children. 40% of this age class have no opportunity to get an education. And this is the main reason that 3 million children are missing out on an education, according to the UNICEF report.
With a new government in charge, Murtada hopes that the education system can change and he can pursue his dreams of getting a good education. Neba Muhiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Well, President Donald Trump has proposed a dramatic rollback of environmental oversight that would clear the way and speed up development of a wide range of commercial projects by cutting back federal review of their impact on the environment. The proposal calls for narrowing the scope of the National Environmental Policy Act, which was signed into law by Republican President Richard Nixon in 1970. It was one of the first fundamental environmental laws of that era, along with the Clean Air and Water Act. Joining us to talk more about this and what it would mean is Sharon Buccino, Senior Director of the Land Division Nature Program with the Natural Resources Defense Council. Thank you for being with us. So would this be something the president can do without congressional approval?
What's at stake are their proposed rules, and these are the rules that are implementing a statute that Congress passed, yes, 50 years ago now, the National Environmental Policy Act. So he can change the rules, but he's limited in what he can do in a couple of ways. One is that the changes he makes to the rules have to be consistent with the statute. And what we have in the National Environmental Policy Act is actually it's an incredible vision of a sustainable future, a future that works for all of us, and a requirement for the government to ensure that it has analyzed the impacts, the environmental impacts of its decisions, and that the public has a right to participate in the review and the decision making.
What kinds of things could this impact? What would reversing this do? And what would be the point of reversing it?
So that's one of the reasons why I think Trump took this on and why it's so significant is that it really cuts across all kinds of activities that affect our daily lives. It affects highway projects, bridges, steps coastal cities are taking right now to address rising sea levels. It affects how we're using our public lands, oil and gas drilling both onshore and offshore. It affects communities where waste sites or incinerators might be cited. So it's anything that the federal government has some kind of role in approving or funding.
So what you're saying is that these industries, like major projects from pipelines to commercial development, they could just fast track without investigating into the environmental impacts that it would have?
Right. So they still need the approval, but what we have, there are a couple of key significant changes that are being made that, one, limit the kinds of activities that have to have any kind of review of their impacts, and then, two, for the limited number of projects that still will have some kind of review, it's dramatically truncated what's involved in that review. And one key aspect of that is the proposal changes the definition of what counts as an effect or an impact that needs to be analyzed, and it has removed from that definition looking at cumulative impacts, and it's also removed looking at indirect impacts.
Who does this benefit?
It benefits the fossil fuel industry for sure. It's a response to not only public pressure and clamor to address climate change, but the courts have consistently held now that climate change impacts are the kind of indirect and cumulative impacts that NEPA requires the federal government to address. So that is calling into question a lot of the investments we're making right now in the fossil fuel space.
What actions have you all been taking to address this?
Primarily, you know, most immediately, we're trying to explain what's at stake, what is being changed, what the consequences of that are. There is now a public comment period that NRDC and others will submit comments on, and depending on the response to those comments, NRDC could very well take the administration to court. So going back again to who benefits and who loses, what we have in this action is really placing the profits of a few over what's good for the rest of us, and that's not something that NRDC is going to stand silently by and let happen. What's at stake here? It's not the National Environmental Policy Act. Yes, it's an environmental law, but it's more than that. It is a law that's at the core of our democracy, and we are a democracy. We're not a dictatorship. And so there are reasons for looking at these impacts and involving the public so that we make informed and smart decisions as a nation. And those decisions, those wise decisions, are what's at risk here. Losing not only the right to participate, but losing what NEPA promises, a sustainable and prosperous future for us all.
All right, that's Sharon Vecino, Senior Director of the Land Division Nature Program with the Natural Resources Defense Council. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition. We will be right back.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, there has been a big push across Europe to return priceless art to African nations. In France, several private art dealers now are getting ready to return rare treasures to Benin. Joining us for more on this is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. It sounds like all these private collectors in France bought up some pretty rare African artifacts that had been looted from France many, many, many years ago, and they are now returning them to galleries in Benin.
Yes, indeed. These are 27 artifacts. In fact, we've got 17 scepters, 8 sabers, and 2 objects of worship that are going to be handed back formally to a very small museum in Benin on Friday. These artifacts were actually up for sale at an auction in Western France last year. They'd been in private collections in France, and it was just this, you know, this whole collection of gallery owners who have taken it upon themselves to try and get these works of art, these cultural treasures returned to Benin, bought them, and are now getting ready for a bit of ceremony, indeed, on Friday to hand them back. And they say it's just one small step in what is meant to be a very long process to hand back all the cultural and artistic heritage that was looted by the French at the end of the 19th century.
And is this something that was initially instigated by French President Emmanuel Macron as far as getting these treasures back to their rightful place?
No, this particular initiative is completely private. They got no government funding, and all these objects were in private hands. So that made it slightly easier. As for President Macron of France, indeed, in November 2017, he made an undertaking saying that he would make sure that art that was looted by French troops would be returned. And in fact, he has said that there are 26 objects in a museum here in Paris that do need to go back to Benin. That, of course, as I said, was in November 2017. Nothing has happened since then. And that's been the problem, is that these objects that are in French hands, that are in French government's hands, actually belong to the state. So the French need to bring in a law to remove them from state ownership and then hand them over. But that doesn't seem to be happening. And even though last month the French culture minister went to Benin and said that these objects need to be given back, still none have been given back. And it doesn't seem as though there's anywhere on the agenda for this current legislative period, is there any move through Parliament to change the law allowing for these treasures, which includes thrones and bronzes, to be returned to Benin.
So, Catherine, is there any other way to get these objects back to Africa without changing the law?
There is one way, and that would be that they agreed a sort of a nation-by-nation loan, which is one instance has already happened. In fact, it happened in December when the French Prime Minister handed to the Museum of Black Civilizations in Senegal, handed them a sword, which was originally from Senegal. So it was made into a loan. So if you like, it was lent back to Senegal, even though that's where it originally came from. But of course, the other issue, which a lot of the French cultural elite are saying, is that the security is not in place, that there really aren't the museums in place where these objects would be safe. And when you look at where they're kept in museums in Paris, yes, they're safe, they're well protected, they're kept in perfect climatic conditions. The question is, yes, these countries do need better museums, do need better cultural centres, but certainly they will need more help from the French government to be able to actually build, restore, and even train staff to work in these museums.
All right, Paris-based journalist Catherine Field, thank you for being with us. Well, pop diva Mariah Carey, who has co-written 18 of her 19 number one hit songs, will finally be inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame. Carey, whose hits include We Belong Together and Hero, released her self-titled debut album in 1990. With 19 number one hits on the Billboard Hot 100 chart, she is only behind the Beatles, who have had 20 songs top the chart. Her holiday staple, the 25-year-old All I Want for Christmas Is You, reached the number one spot on the Hot 100 in December and January, making Carey the only artist to have number one hits in the 90s, 2000s, 2010s, and the 2020s. That you would always be mine. Now you wanna be free, so I let you fly. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. Time can erase a feeling in the street.
This is VOA News.